Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Don Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
So, Melanie, we have a little bit of feedback this week. We got
I love feedback.
Feedback is awesome. We love to get feedback from you all, and we especially love if you have suggestions for things you'd like us to talk about or questions or that sort of thing. So we love to hear that. This feedback comes from Rashad on YouTube. We do post the podcast as audio on the StarQuest YouTube channel, youtube.com/StarQuestMedia. And Rashad is responding to our discussion about the Age of Ultron last time. And so here's what Rashad says. After watching Person of Interest and then Age of Ultron after, I felt that they didn't do enough to play up a super powerful and intelligent AI. In Person of Interest, the machine had the power of manipulating populaces through social media and information warfare. Couple that kind of intelligence and speed and planning with an actual body, and it should have made him way more deadly to deal with. Instead, Ultron was just another supervillain, kind of strong, kind of smart, but not at all taking advantage of the powers that a distributed superintelligence would have.
Man, I love this comment because, well, Person of Interest was one of my favorite TV shows. We loved watching that show. I like the comparison, and definitely like Ultron should have been scarier. I think the one mitigating circumstance might be that Ultron was a very, very new baby computer, whereas the computer AI in Person of Interest had a much longer run of
Right. It'd been around since 9/11.
Right. It had a much longer training run of learning how to use the tools to identify persons of interest. And I think that the implication was that it was getting better and better all the time at using those tools of surveillance, mm-hmm. et cetera. Whereas Ultron, I think, while he had a sort of general mandate, I'm not sure that he or Jarvis had the training for the specific tools, but being a super intelligent supercomputer, he probably should have learned more quickly than he did.
Right. If he had the capabilities they said he did, because they talked about him being in the net, then he should have been able to, you know, monitor every phone, every, security camera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he didn't. He should have seen them coming every single time. But of course, if he had those capabilities, then that would have been a very short movie and they would have lost. So there had to be some limitations placed on Ultron in order for the good guys to win.
Yeah. Plus, I kind of get the feeling that you're right. He's sort of just another supervillain because really the MCU is focusing on getting us to
Thanos.
Thanos, yeah. And Endgame. Like Ultron is just sort of a...
Well, he's a tool to get the Sokovia Accord things, the Sokovia Accords going, right?
Right, and create those conflicts there.
The Civil War, bring us to Captain America Civil War, and right.
Yeah. I feel like they weren't as invested in really exploring the possibilities of what Ultron could have meant.
You could have
or
made,
should have meant.
You could have made Ultron the big baddie of this phase of the MCU.
It's true. He could have got... I mean, would that have required more than one movie? Like, if Ultron had been as powerful as the computer in Person of Interest, I think that one movie wouldn't have done it. Have done it justice.
And then you would have had much more between him and Vision, and there would have been.
I think you would have required a multiple movie arc to really do Ultron justice,
running through both Avengers, but also running through the other movies. You know, and he could have been building up his capabilities as opposed to all happening in one movie. I still like the movie, but
I do. I do too. I liked it. Yeah. I said a lot better the second time through too. But
it's like a lot of supervillains. They make them so powerful in concept, and then like the writers do, and then they have to dial it back or introduce that fatal flaw in order to let our heroes defeat them in 90 minutes.
Right. There's sort of a limitations of storytelling.
Right. Whereas with Person of Interest, they had, what was it, 5 seasons, 6 seasons?
Right.
To grow the computer and to explore who it is, which is something, again, why I think today the streaming series format is a better storytelling format. I mean, you look at Falcon and Winter Soldier compared to Captain America Winter Soldier. You know, you'd had a 6 or 8 or 10 hours to tell that story, it would have been a different, I think, almost more interesting story.
Yeah, I agree.
Like, I mean, I love the movie, but yeah.
Longer format is generally yields better story. Not always.
Sometimes there's padding in the longer format.
Right. But sometimes some stories want more time to be told.
Yes.
They want more space for scope.
Right. So thank you, Rashad, for your feedback, your comment. We really appreciate it. And let us think and let us talk about one of our favorite shows, Person of Interest. I really wish Person of Interest was on when we were doing the podcast so we could talk about it more regularly.
Oh, man. Person of Interest was such a great show.
It was so good.
Really. Oh, one of my favorites.
Yeah. And such a interesting different Jim Caviezel.
Very. Other things. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, really good. All right, so let's talk about what's been going on. If you've been watching the news, you may have noticed that we got a little snow.
Little being an understatement.
So the whole Mid-Atlantic East Coast got snow. This from this blizzard,
right?
And the spot that got the very most snow was where we are.
Let's just say I went into the front yard, and in the places where it was shallowest, it was over my knees. In the places where it was deepest, it was mid-thigh, or those were the deeper drifts. The really tall ones were like shoulder high,
right,
on me.
So it's a blizzard, which means the wind was blowing greater than 35 miles an hour at times. In fact, the National Weather Service said we got up to 40 or 50 miles an hour.
The wind was kind of crazy for a while there.
Yeah, and when it blows that hard, it's hard to get a good definitive this is how deep it is, because you get these crazy drifts and then there are bare spots on the ground. It's wild. But in shelter protected areas, when you look at when you average it out, I'd say so. There's no official measurement for Holbrook.
Yeah,
but surrounding towns were like 24, 27,
30.
There was a couple of 30s not too far away, and I think we got up there. I think we were between 24 and 30.
I would say somewhere the average around the yards, and I wandered all through the front yard and backyard, was at least a good 24 to 30 inches.
Now, I want to make sure people understand, we live in the Boston area, and we get snow. But a storm that deep is unusual. Four storms in Boston for depth of snow. I mean, this was then extremely unusual. So that is quite a lot of snow. But I have to say, this was for me personally, the easiest snow removal storm since we moved here.
It was super light and fluffy.
Yes. So it was very cold air, which meant very dry, but also in dry air means more depth. So the higher the temperature, the closer to freezing it is, and the wetter the snow is, the less depth.
Yeah, I think this is the coldest of the snowstorms I've seen.
It was single digits at points.
Yeah, it was like blindingly white snow with whipping white out
conditions. Yeah,
and it was 10 degrees.
Right.
Which is, that's unusual. Usually when it snows, it's a lot warmer.
It's close to freezing, usually.
Right.
So it was light and fluffy. Had the help of the kids, which was good. And you, thank you very much. And then the snowplow driver, the town snowplow driver, for whatever reason, I don't know, he's taken a shine to us. He's been taking the end off the driveway. Again, if you don't get snow, the worst part of moving the snow is the end of the driveway, because when the plows come by, they push the snow off the street to the side, and that side is either your lawn or your driveway. And so that can get twice as deep as everywhere else. But he took the end off of our driveway.
That,
I don't know why, but thank you very much.
It was quite nice.
maybe he's got a like a crush on you or something. He saw you out there, and
I think he's seen the kids out there shoveling without one of us present, and assumed that, you know, he's helping out the kids.
Yeah, because like the last storm, Ben was out there, and he did come by and take that off. So, yeah, thank you very much. But it wasn't that bad. It was pretty good. So,
not to mention that the way the wind was blowing, like the space on the passenger side of the van,
the lee of the in the wind, yeah,
it had like the
it was bare pavement.
It was bare pavement,
yeah,
right next to the van, which was crazy.
It's crazy. So, our friend Jen from Jen Fitz, from she lives in the Carolinas, north or south, they get like an inch of snow, and it's remarkable. But she was saying that she still goes back to this blog post I wrote in 2010, which was titled Tips for Texans When Dealing with Snow, which was a post I wrote for Melanie and her sister, who was living with us at the time, with all of the gathered wisdom for dealing with snowstorms that I had acquired over, you know, 50 years of living in snowbound places.
Uh-huh.
Well, 40 at the time.
Not 50 back then.
Oh, man, I'm so old. And she says she still refers to it. And then someone else chimed in. Oh, yeah. I mean, I've lived in snowy areas for ages, and there's stuff in there that I didn't, you know, hadn't thought of and stuff. So I'll put a link to it in the show notes. But I thought it was a useful exercise for me to just put that all down, you know, on quote unquote paper back then.
Right.
And it's still good advice. So if you ever find yourself moving to places with snow, you might be.
So this was for people who were like dealing with New England level snow, not like Texas level snow, right?
Yeah. Or yeah. I mean, Texas. Yeah. Texas gets snow occasionally, but there's even stuff in there for like, make sure you have your snow brush from your car, but maybe put it inside the house instead of in the car, so that when, you know, before the snowstorm, so that you don't have to unbury your car to get at the thing that helps you unbury the car.
Right. That's smart.
That sort of stuff. So, yeah. So I mean, there's stuff in there that for anybody who will get snow could help with. But if you're moving someplace that gets a lot of snow, there's some especially good wisdom in there, I think.
Okay.
So because it was snowing all day, there was that when you get a lot of snow, you get that I need to nest thing. What's that word? The Slavic word? Scandinavian word? Hygge.
Oh, right.
That feeling of snuggly comfort.
Yeah, yeah. Bella made chocolate chip cookies, and you were like cooking up a storm.
I was. Ah. Yeah, cooking up. I see what you did there. Very nice. Stealing my puns.
Usually it's me who's doing all the cooking, but I didn't actually do any cooking on Saturday for once.
Yeah, you got to hang. Weird. Yeah, I mean, you did some other stuff. Helping kids get in and out of their snow.
I swear that took half the day. Yeah.
They were out like a blizzard. Okay, this is, you know, think they'll make it. They won't make it past the first marker, like level of Empire Strikes Back on Hoth snow. Okay, and our kids are out there in the front yard, gallivanting around 40-mile-an-hour winds.
I don't think they lasted for more than about 5 minutes, though. In the high winds.
Yeah. But at one point, Ben was swinging on the swing. I wanted to get a video of him swinging on the swing in the middle of the blizzard. They are real New England kids. But so Bella made chocolate chip cookies.
They're so good.
Yeah. Chocolate chip cookies are so deceptive because they're so easy to make, you know, but they're so good.
Mm-hmm.
I used to make them on my lunch break when I worked the student job at the Franciscan University. I worked in the business office as a student job, and I would go home at lunch, whip up cookies and bring them back for the ladies who worked in the office. Guess who was the favorite?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, back to the storm. Well, and then like consequences of the storm, it takes time to clean up. I mean, our road out front is still one lane. I think, I don't think they've cleared the double lane out. And, but the churches were closed. So today too.
Yeah. They,
yeah,
said that there was no way they were going to get the snow removed from the parking lots in order to have people come to mass.
Yeah, yeah. That's the big thing, is sidewalks got to get cleared, the roads have to get cleared, and the parking lots have to get cleared. And until all that gets done, and then there's like a shortage of plow truck drivers this year. I saw one town was offering to pay $200 an hour.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm like, I'll shove a plow in the front of my Honda. I'll get out there for $200 an hour. Yeah, that was pretty impressive. But yeah, so we ended up having to watch the Catholic TV Mass this morning, which we'll talk about later. But yeah, so we got the storm. And yeah, we woke up today and it was bright, sunny day. It was beautiful out there. I love that first bright, sunny morning after the storm.
Yeah, I didn't get to go outside today because we somehow managed to lose a pair of snow pants. And so Anthony was wearing Ben's snow pants. Ben was wearing Sophie's snow pants. So Sophie ended up wearing my snow pants. And then I couldn't go outside because there weren't any snow pants for me.
So we're missing Ben's snow pants somewhere?
Ben says he thinks that his are missing. I think that Anthony was wearing his.
Okay. But like they come in and they explode. Like these winter clothes go flying off in all directions. So I'm not surprised.
I don't know. I'm going to buy some more snow pants.
Yeah. Yeah. I have snow pants for the first time this winter. I haven't had snow pants. And so like I would just wear regular khakis with maybe long underwear underneath and they would get wet. I would get cold. And I would suck
it
up
miserable.
because I'm from Boston. I'm a New Englander, you know, you just deal with it. I've decided that's dumb. And I finally got snow pants that fit and I was nice and comfortable.
Yeah, mine don't actually fit anymore. I'm having to hold them on with. Well, I don't have a belt that fits either, so I'm using a scarf. But but they're way too big for Sophie's. So, yeah.
Yeah, she was using her scout belt to hold them up, I think.
She was.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
Important piece of equipment.
So let's talk about food, all that food we were making.
Right.
So one of the things I was cooking was some beef pho stock. So pho, that Vietnamese beef soup, has a, it's basically a beef stock, but you add various spices to it. In fact, I forgot to look up exactly what I added. Let me quickly open that up.
To make it super aromatic.
To give it that particular pho smell and flavor.
It's got like star anise, right?
Well, it would if I could have found the star anise. I ended up using aniseed. I didn't have any star anise, so I
really?
I looked in every
one
of our spice
bins.
I swear
you bought star anise.
I thought so too. But I threw it out in a previous clear out because when am I ever going to use this?
I can't imagine you doing that.
I don't usually do that, but I couldn't find it. So I'm going to get some more from the spice house when I make the next order. But in the meantime, aniseeds work pretty well. I looked it up and they're a decent substitution. So aniseed. So what are we? Well, back up. I've had bones in the freezer, beef bones that I've been meaning to make beef stock for ages.
More than 2 years?
More than three. And so I put the bones in the pot, fill it with water, rinse the bones. That's a big thing. Then fill it up again, boil it, then pour all the water off and then wash out the pot. The bone, there's just all kinds of blech on the bones. And even then, there was still a lot of I had to do a lot of skimming to get the scum off. But you fill it up again and then you let it simmer for, I think, 6 hours. I let it go. And for the last hour, you add in your aromatics. But before you do that, you put them in a cast iron pan and you toast them. So like first you toasted, there was a garlic, ginger, aniseeds, coriander seeds, a cinnamon stick, whole cloves. I forgot the peppercorns, but that's not a big deal. I don't think that was I don't think it missed it. And I think I had something else on there too. And then onion that I toasted the onion. I also threw some fennel seeds and cardamom seeds. That was the other stuff. And threw them all in the pot for the last hour. And then strained it out, poured them into containers. And I've got like, 6 quarts in the freezer for that.
That's a lot.
Yes. So we're going to do pho some night. I got to actually get the rest of the ingredients to make pho. So I need some like the rice noodles and I need some the thinly sliced beef and cilantro and stuff. We're just out of a bunch of stuff. So I want to make sure we get a bunch of good stuff. So that was the pho and it smelled good.
It did smell really good.
And it smelled like pho. I mean, that's what I wanted. So that was that. But for dinner, We made roast beef. So I got a nice roast on sale at the market this week, and they come in the vacuum packages now. They're not just like plastic wrapped on a cardboard tray. They vacuum seal it. And it was frozen solid. We put it in the freezer, and you had the idea, well, why don't we sous vide it?
Well, yeah, because I didn't think we were going to have enough time to
defrost it and then cook it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I got the sous vide out, and is that
the word sous vide?
I got the sous vide. Yes, it is now. if it ain't the word before, it is the word now. Thank you. Put a stamp on that. Mark the date. Sous vide. So I got the sous vide machine immersion heater out, popped the roast, the still in its vacuum seal pack, in the water with the thing. I've set it to 132 degrees and set it going. And that was going to go for 5 hours. Then I looked it up, recipes for sous vide roast beef.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So apparently everyone thinks you need to if you're going to do a sous vide roast, you need to do it for 18 to 24 hours.
Yeah, that wasn't happening.
Yeah, well, we were going to eat today, not tomorrow. So, yeah, that was...
Although I did suggest at one point that maybe we should just, like, scrap it and make it Sunday dinner instead of Saturday dinner.
Yes, yeah, you did suggest that. Although, I was like, do we really want to have this sitting on the counter...
Taking up space
and making noise all night long.
It did make a... It made a lot of noise.
It does make
whiny noise.
Well, it's like a hot tub going, which is essentially, it's a teeny tiny hot tub.
A hot tub for your meat.
Okay, then. So moving on. So I figured, you know what can we lose? If I get it up to temp, if I get it up to 132 in internal temperature, that's medium rare. Then I'll just throw it in a hot oven for a little while to brown the outside and it'll be fine.
Right.
That was my hope.
That was the theory.
So I heated the oven to 550. I wanted that rocket hot. Then I took the meat out of the water, took it out of its bag, wiped it off because it was all, you know, the juices on it, salted it. And that's the only downside is if you could salt it ahead of time, you'd get more penetration of the salt. But I salted it, stuck it on the rack, in the roasting pan, in the oven, and then turned the oven down to 350. So I didn't want to get it too hot,
right?
From the outside. And then I checked it at 20 minutes, and it had dropped to 119. So then I checked it again, and I think another 10 minutes, and then another 5 minutes, and finally it was right there. Took it out, let it rest, sliced it up. How was it?
It was tender. It was perhaps the most tender roast beef you've ever made.
Yeah.
I have to say.
It did not need 24 hours in the sous vide. But I forgot to look at what kind of roast it was. It's a regular, it wasn't like a chuck roast or something that's really lots of fat and connective tissue. It was already.
I thought it was like a top round.
I think it was a top round. It was, like I said, it was on pretty good sale at the market, which I was surprised. It was like half price. So it was already pretty good. That kind of meat, but it was really good. It was really tender. A lot of good flavor. So, yep.
And then you made little.
I made Yorkshire pudding.
The Yorkshire puddings and the muffin tins, which was really nice.
Yeah. Yeah. A little overdone, but otherwise.
Yeah.
Really
yeah.
Good.
I would have done a couple minutes less.
Yeah. The recipe wanted it in there that long, but I should have taken it out a little earlier. Yeah. The thing that confounds me is all the Yorkshire pudding recipes you see. I was like, so take all of the beef drippings and put, you know, you add them to the recipe. I'm like, I never have, like,
no
more than a half a teaspoon of beef drippings.
I'm thinking beef used to be a lot fattier than it is these days.
That's what I'm thinking. So, that was dinner. It was a mighty fine blizzard day dinner.
It was good.
So you, the other night, you made a zuppa Toscana that you've been meaning to make.
I think I did that on Friday or Thursday.
Thursday or Friday. Yeah. I forget.
I'd seen somebody post on Facebook, like a picture of a zuppa Toscana that they'd made. And I said, that looks really good. So it's basically just Italian sausage, like bulk crumbled. Italian sausage,
yep.
Crumbled and cooked. If you have it in the casing, you take it out of the casing, which you so kindly did.
Yes.
And then just in a chicken broth with some white wine and, potatoes and a green. This recipes I looked at is called for either baby spinach or baby kale, or we ended up using chard. Now, the recipes I called for didn't have like the mirepoix, the celery, carrot, onion. They just had onion. Well, that did not seem like enough to me. So mm-hmm. I cut up some celery and carrot and onion and garlic and threw them in there first, and then added the meat and the broth, lots of white wine, and then lots of heavy cream at the end. You wait to add the sausage until the very end, so it maintains some of its crispness, because you want to cook it until it's a dark brown with a nice crispy outer texture. And the recipe called for bacon, and it just seemed like way too much work by the time I got there. And
you already have all that sausage in there.
With all the sausage, it just felt like bacon would have been, I don't know, gilding the lily. It too much. So I skipped this. I mean, it would have been okay. It's kind of weird to say that like bacon would be too much because I love bacon, but frying up some bacon would have just been annoying at that point. I was tired.
Right.
I was done.
For a weeknight dinner, that's another step.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was good. It was really, really good.
Makes good leftovers too.
Yeah. Very creamy. Loved the sausage in it. Would have been good with some crusty bread. We had it with biscuits, actually, because Bella ended up making biscuits that night.
Mm-hmm.
We had some left. We mostly ate the biscuits for tea time, afternoon snack. But I think there was enough left over for everybody to have a biscuit with the soup.
Yeah. So that's...
It was yummy. It's not a traditional Italian dish. It is like an Italian-American dish.
In fact, I think it's almost like from the Olive Garden, recipe.
I think the original recipe is an Olive Garden recipe. But you know what? It's good. It's really, really, really good. Very nice, filling, creamy, rich soup. I loved it. So, you know, sometimes the hybrid food is great.
Yeah. Why not? I mean, in the restaurant, maybe it's not as good as even making it at home, but
maybe the I don't concept remember. Is good. Right, I don't remember ever having this in the restaurant. Like, it was kind of a new recipe to me. I'd never eaten it before, but it looked like it would be tasty, so I figured I'd try it.
I need to confess, I've never been to an Olive Garden.
Really? We used to go to the Olive Garden all the time when I was a kid, but we didn't live in, like, Boston.
That's like, they don't have Red Lobster in the Boston area. Like, why would they?
Right. Yeah. You
know, and I mean, I'm sure there are Olive Gardens around here, but I'm not many. I mean, that's Yeah.
It was a feature of my childhood. So
unlimited breadsticks. I know that much.
Yeah. And, you know, breadsticks when they're hot are tasty.
Even like mass produced restaurant ones.
You know, there is something magical about hot bread. I remember one of the field trips that we used to do when I was in elementary school was going to the bread bakery, like local Austin bakery, Mrs. Baird's Bread.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the tour, like you get to tour the whole assembly line, et cetera, they hand everybody a little mini loaf of bread, like, you know, maybe like a hot dog bun size, hot, right out of the oven bread. I don't think at that point in my life I had ever had hot out of the oven bread.
Uh-huh.
My mom was not a baker.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, she ended up getting a bread machine. But at that point, I'd never had, and I thought it was the best thing I'd ever eaten in my life. And I remember insisting that my mom start buying Mrs. Baird's bread. Brilliant marketing, by the way, like having the local kids. Of course, the store-bought bread in the bag was never...
Because it wasn't as fresh.
Because it wasn't hot and hot, fresh buttered bread. But, I just remember how magical that first taste of fresh bread from the oven.
That's why restaurants used to give rolls, hot, fresh rolls, at the beginning of dinner. Some still do, obviously, like Bertucci's and Jake's, our favorite seafood restaurant does.
Not your average Joe's does, too.
Yes, but, you know, many don't. But there's a reason they do it, because it's so good.
It's so good. So very good. Excuse
me. Speaking of bread machines, I mean, those used to be big. They used to be a thing.
Oh, yeah. My mom was a huge bread machine. The loaves came out like weird shape looking.
Weird tubes.
With a hole in the bottom of it where the paddle was. But you know what? It was hot.
It was hot, fresh bread.
Fresh bread. And it was easy.
My first roommate in Steubenville had a bread machine, Jerry, and he would like run it every couple days. And that was his bread. And I'm like, it made the apartment smell awesome. So, yeah.
Right. So tasty.
I had a bread machine for a while, but then I learned how easy it is to actually just make bread.
Right.
It's not that hard. It's not that much harder than just a bread
machine.
It
isn't that much harder. Yeah. But to me, bread seemed like this mystical thing. Like, like you had to have some sort of like genius in order to bake it from scratch without a bread machine.
It is the stuff of life that people have been, every mom in every village everywhere has made from time immemorial. It is the staff of life. Yeah. We've kind of turned it into this special scary thing that only you can only get at a store or be a really, you'd think that you have to be super awesome at it. It's not that hard to make bread. Anyway, that's what we've been eating. Let's talk about stuff we've been watching. So you and I, the other night, finally got to watch this movie that everybody's been talking about, apparently, called Encanto. It's a Pixar animated movie that is set in Colombia. And is about this family, the Madrigal family, who are they all have magic powers except for one of the children in the family. Her name is Mirabel, and she does not.
Right.
So that's the basic premise. If you haven't seen the movie, you don't want to be spoiled, maybe skip ahead 5 or 10 minutes or so, because we're going to probably spoil some things, maybe not everything, but maybe we might spoil it a little bit.
Well, right. We'll try not to do too spoilery, right, but I kind of want to talk about it.
Yes. So the music is by Lin-Manuel Miranda. So, right. And it's catchy as you would expect. It has his signature style.
Although I honestly felt like it was catchy, but it was not as catchy as I expected. I was slightly disappointed in the music, I have to say.
Hmm.
I mean, the big songs.
Right. Well, the one everybody knows.
The one everyone knows. We don't talk about Bruno. Was excellent. It was a very catchy song. Everything else I thought was like, it was okay.
Yeah.
It wasn't, but I did not leave like singing the song. They're not stuck in my head. And I think I would have
not
to
like
listen.
Not like Moana.
Not like Moana. Like Moana, I felt like the music really just grabbed me.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like this didn't as much. And I was a little bit surprised. So I don't know.
Okay.
Maybe it's just me.
So the other thing, the first impression I had was, oh, it's another movie where the family is cruel to the one member who doesn't measure up to the rest and then will be accepted finally when it turns out that they do measure up in a particular way and therefore they can be acceptable. That's what I thought was going to be the trope.
It's a very standard.
It wasn't.
It's a very standard plot line, and I've seen it in lots of movies.
Right. Lots of animated kids movies and shows. This did not do that, actually. I'm glad that they veered off from that. So it wasn't that. So I was glad to see that. So it deals with some very significant traumatic stuff. I mean, the family, it starts with this, they tell the story of how this woman and her husband and their triplets were forced from their homes. They were refugees, a militia or something, a war, whatever.
So I think it's the Colombian Civil War.
Sure.
But it doesn't really specify.
Right. Like, and so as they were escaping with other people from their village into the mountains, the bad guys caught up to them and her husband dies.
Like any good animated movie for kids, it does not show him dying.
He literally fades out from the screen.
Right. But it's very clear that he was killed by the soldiers who were chasing them.
Right. And in that moment of grief, the woman has a candle that she'd been carrying for light suddenly acquires this magical properties, and magic is infused in her and her children.
Right. It creates a refuge for them in the mountains, like a hidden valley that can't be found by outsiders.
And builds a magical house for them to live in. And then all the other people create a town around this magical house. And then years later, those kids have grown up and they each have an individual magical power. And then their kids each have their own specific magical power that they get when they come of age.
Right. There's a special coming of age ceremony where they are handed the magic candle, and then they're led to a door and they touch a doorknob, and then they acquire a magical power.
The magical power is revealed.
Right.
So one is like Mirabelle's mom can heal any wound by feeding someone.
Magic food.
Magic food.
I love the magic food.
Yes.
It's really kind of cool.
Food is life. And all of the magical powers kind of embody some sort of element of they all serve the community.
Right. In a way, they're all kind of a response to the trauma of being refugees, of losing mm-hmm. the grandfather. The paterfamilias, they kind of all embody some sort of a survival response.
Right. So healing through food or caring response. So someone who like to care for people that are in your charge. So healing through food, I keep saying that over and over again. One of the triplets is, she's particularly good at growing food, but she also creates weather through her moods.
Right. I think her gift is her mood creates the weather.
Right. So when she's in a bad mood, it rains. When she's in a good mood, it's sunny, etc. Then the third one is Bruno.
We don't talk about Bruno.
But Bruno sees the future.
Right. His gift is prophetic.
Right. So we'll come back to Bruno. Then their kids. So the two sisters had kids, and so I can never remember the names of the characters, but Mirabelle's mom had two other daughters first, Luisa, who is super strong, and Isabella, who is she makes flowers grow wherever she goes, and she's perfect and poised and always and graceful and all that sort of thing. And then the other sister had two children. I don't remember the name of the daughter, but the daughter has super hearing. She can hear a pin drop from a mile away.
She had three kids. And then she had two boys.
Two boys? Who were the two boys?
The one boy who Camillo. Camillo was a shapeshifter. And uh-huh. then the little boy, Antonio.
Oh, Antonio, yes.
Whose
ceremony occurs during the movie.
The movie opens on the day of his coming of age, getting his power ceremony.
Yes, and his power is communing with animals.
Right. So the movie opens with getting ready for the party, and the village kids asking Mirabelle, well, what's your gift? Since everyone in your family has a gift. And she deflects. She deflects. She deflects. She deflects. She refuses to answer the question. She just wants to talk about how amazing her family is, how wonderful her family is, how lucky she is.
Because
to be
everything is about the family.
In such a gifted family. And she really, really genuinely loves her family. And is
she has a role in the family, too, despite not having a magical power. I think that's a big part of it, too.
Right. She seems to have this special relationship with the house, which is kind of...
The house does things. The house
it's kind of alive.
Can act in its environment. Yeah.
It kind of is like a sentient house.
Yes.
And Mirabelle seems to have a special connection with it even beyond that of the other family members, which seems to be kind of her gift, but it's not an official formal...
Magical power.
According to Hoyle, magical power, so it doesn't count. Which I think is kind of weird.
It's also unclear what magical power Abuela, the grandmother, has.
Well, her magical power was founding the town, I think.
In being the keeper of the flame, literally, of her family.
Right.
And she's traumatized, obviously, by losing her husband and losing her home, and she's very afraid of losing the miracle. She keeps referring to the miracle.
Right. And she's very much kind of a perfectionist. She mm-hmm. she's sort of the stereotype of
the stern,
the mother of the family for whom nothing can ever be good enough. And everyone's always trying to measure up and can't quite measure up to her standards of perfection, mm-hmm. especially not Mirabelle, who's the disappointment because she doesn't have a magic power.
Well, I think partly because Mirabelle represents a potential loss for her. Like if something is wrong with the magic, you know, Mirabelle represents that. And if something's wrong with the magic, it means they could lose their home again. And that is a trauma for her. So she is she's afraid of losing her home.
It's very much a movie about trauma and about sort of intergenerational trauma and how it shapes families and how it shapes family dynamics. But it's a movie in which that's healed, which it was really, I really thought that they dealt with showing how the mother's trauma affected all of the kids. And it really does, like the sister who controls the weather is afraid of being in a bad mood because her bad mood makes it rain. And so whenever the little storm cloud appears that shows that she's in a bad mood, she tries to chase it away. Like, I am not allowed to be sad. I'm not allowed to be angry or upset. I have to always put on the perfect, happy, smiling face because otherwise things might fall apart.
Well, and sometimes Abuela will say to her, you know, let's call her Tina. Tina, take the cloud, you know, like put on the happy face.
Right. And there's this sense of everyone's kind of tiptoeing around because they don't want grandma to be upset. And that's really the family dynamic, which is a very unhealthy dynamic. Yeah. And it's very clear that it's meant to read as unhealthy from the get-go.
And then there's also this town that the family has been told that they serve, that this is their reason for being and the reason for their powers is to serve the people of the town. And the town people themselves, if you notice, they get very, they take them for granted a bit. They rely on the Madrigal family to do everything for them.
To do things that they could do themselves. Like, Luisa is very, very strong, and she can pick up, like, and carry 8 donkeys at once. Right. So when the donkeys get out of their enclosure, they call on her, Luisa, the donkeys are out again, come and get them. Which is, honestly,
dude, go get it yourself. They're your donkeys.
rounding up donkeys is maybe not the best use of extreme magical strength. Like,
right.
It feels like they've got this weird dependent relationship on the family that's troublesome from the get-go.
And then by the end of the movie, though, the town learns that they have to serve the family too, that the family has needs that they need to take care of. I mean, at times Luisa is just terrified of failing in her duties, of not being strong enough to do what she's expected of her.
I have to say, the one song that, in addition to We Don't Talk About Bruno, that I did find really
compelling
was Luisa's song, where she talks about the need to be strong and the fear of not being strong enough. It was really, like, talking about the tension that was always under the surface, right under her skin, and her fear of failure, her fear of letting everybody down.
Right. Okay, so now it's time
to talk about Bruno.
So Bruno suffers for having the gift of prophecy, because when you think about it, if you have the gift of prophecy, everyone's going to expect everything you say to be a prophecy, that it's going to come true. Even if you're commenting on the weather, looks like it's going to rain. Oh, great. Now you're causing the weather to be bad. Well, and then if you have the gift of prophecy, people will start to attribute you to causing it, not just seeing it.
Right. So it's the Cassandra problem, right? Nobody wants to listen to Cassandra because she tells about the bad things that are going to happen.
Right.
So either they don't believe her or they get mad at her and want to kill
her. Shoot the messenger.
Right. Shoot the messenger. So Bruno said something about the weather on his sister's wedding day. And so then she got upset, and then she had a hurricane on her wedding day, and it must have been Bruno's fault.
Except she's the one who creates weather by her moods.
There's a deflection. Like, she's happily married, so it wasn't really a bad omen, but it wasn't the perfect wedding day either.
Like the village guy who's like, he said, he told me it looked like he was putting on a few pounds. And look at me, I've got this huge belly.
Or he said something about my fish and then my fish died. And then the priest, he said, I looked like my hair was getting thin and now look, I'm bald.
Right. By the way, there was a priest in this village, in a church.
Although, this is true.
The ecclesial geek, theology geek in me says, how did the diocese assign the priest to the parish in the magical village?
maybe he was escaping with them from their initial village and he's just
been there with them for 50 years.
It's possible. I don't know.
He didn't look that old, but okay. Maybe magic.
Magic.
So anyway, I'm just kidding. It's, you know, you don't look too closely at that. But so Bruno, what I liked about Bruno too is they think that Bruno has left, or he's up in his tower in the house.
But in fact, he's hiding in the walls. His best friends are a bunch of rats, and he's hiding in the walls like one of the rats, like scurrying right around in the spaces of the walls.
But to be close to his family, I think that was the idea.
Right. Like when they sit down for dinner, you see that he's got a table that kind of extends on his side of the wall from where their table is and a place.
A
place setting. So when they sit down, he sits down to eat with them, even though he's separated from them by a wall. There's this.
That is both literal and metaphorical.
Right. There's this longing to belong and this sense of deep connection and yet woundedness because they've rejected him.
It's also clear he has OCD.
I'm not sure, actually. He has a lot of tics that could be OCD or superstition. And sometimes it can be really hard to tell the difference. He crosses himself, he knocks on wood, he throws salt over his shoulder.
Well, there are times where he will do a pattern before he goes, like he will knock on a pattern of things before walking through a door.
Right. But it's interesting, like somebody who has a feeling like everything that bad that happens is dependent on him, you could understand why he would get sucked into OCD-like rituals.
Mm-hmm.
Does he have clinical OCD, or is it like sort of induced by the situation in which he's been thrust, like
right,
by the combination of his prophetic gift plus everybody's bad reactions to it?
Right.
But he's certainly an oddball, and he is definitely traumatized and by the rejection of the family. It's hard to tell what he might have been like absent that rejection.
Yeah. So in the end, it's a pretty good movie. The ending was okay. I mean, it was what you'd expect. It was a pretty good movie. Again, I think Moana was better, a better movie. I liked Moana, but I think the music in Moana was better. I think the general story was better.
Yeah, I feel like
the performances.
Right. I feel like I want to watch Encanto again, though, because a lot of it went really fast.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the songs were really quick and hard to catch the words. And so I felt like I missed something. I missed some things along the way.
Interesting aspect was there was no villain in this. I mean, you had the soldiers who evicted them from the village, but they were faceless and they were in the past. They weren't a present danger.
Right. Right. The villain of the piece is kind of the controlling grandmother matriarch of the family.
Except she's not an evil step grandmother.
Right. She's not evil. She's
hurt. She's traumatized.
Right. She's wounded. She's suffering and nobody sees her pain. And the beautiful thing is that the reconciliation is that the person who sees her is Mirabelle.
Mm-hmm.
But the person who comes to her rescue is Bruno. And so there's this beautiful moment in which the people who she's wounded the most and rejected the most are those who come to her rescue and save her. Like, she needs them to be whole and to be healed. And I liked that conclusion. Like, it really felt like it was about healing family trauma and not perpetuating it. Unlike, say, a movie which I felt like dealt with family trauma in a way that was unsatisfactory was the Snow Queen one.
Frozen.
Frozen.
Yes.
Frozen had a traumatized family, and I don't feel like they ever really had a satisfactory reconciliation, partly because the parents died.
I don't think they dealt with the trauma, really.
I don't think they ever really dealt with it. They rejected Elsa in a way that was unhealthy because they were afraid of her magical gift. But there was never really any satisfactory resolution. The parents died. Anna and Elsa are left as orphans trying to figure out things on their own. And I don't feel like they ever really...
Elsa's solution was to suppress the trauma and declare, I am strong. And I don't care what anybody else thinks.
Yeah, and I feel like while there is a reconciliation between Anna and Elsa, it didn't really address the root of the trauma.
Yeah.
Because it couldn't, because there was no way for her to heal the relationship with her parents.
But there could have been... There's ways to heal from that.
Right, but they didn't try to.
No.
And so I felt like Encanto really dealt with what it looks like to have a wholeness restored
mm-hmm.
in a way that Moana kind of was also about, like having the wholeness, the vision of who they're supposed to be restored.
Did you see Coco?
I did not see Coco.
It would be an interesting comparison between the two, especially because they're similar cultures. That's Mexico. This is Colombia. But also similar kinds of trauma that need to be healed. Related anyway. So that would be interesting. What was the other one? Oh, Luca. That was the other recent Pixar movie, which it's different. It's got a completely different set of, it's not about trauma. It's about, you know, finding your place in the world and that sort of thing. But still, I don't know if I would choose one over the other. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. That I'm not sure one is better than the other from my point of view. So anyway, that's we'll talk about Bruno again in a second, but we did want to talk a little bit about Ant-Man.
Yes.
That was the next movie in the MCU family watch through. That was today.
Yeah. The kids loved it.
We expected
it's a fun action movie with a lot of goofy humor.
Yes. A lot of slapstick, a lot of, you know, funny goofs. Paul Rudd is obviously very funny. It's a palate cleanser between Ultron, which is dark, and Winter Soldier, Civil War, Captain America Civil War, which is next. And you have Ant-Man in the middle to provide a little bit of relief, which I think is a good play on Marvel's part.
I feel like they've got a nice rhythm going with these sort of darker than lighter movies to kind of
mm-hmm.
keep it from being just relentlessly dark.
Yes.
You know, we had Winter Soldier, but then we watched Guardians of the Galaxy, which was a wonderful lighthearted romp comparatively.
Right. Right. It has its moments, but yeah. Well, and then you have even between Infinity War and Endgame, you have Ant-Man and the Wasp, which is another palate cleanser, another lighter movie. And you also have Captain Marvel. So yeah, you don't have that relentless slog through things. I think they have a good pace, good pattern. But other than that, I mean, there's not a lot to say about Ant-Man other than Falcon was great in it. The kids loved Falcon in that.
Yeah.
And the fun of just making things big and making things small.
Right. The humor of the gigantic Thomas the Tank Engine.
They loved that. They just thought that was the yes. funniest thing ever.
I think that it's a nice story about parents and children and relationships too.
Well, again, the whole MCU is about parents and fathers and children, especially, but parents and children. Yeah. And then you have Hope, who lost her mother, and sort of her father, who disengaged after the mother was gone. And then you have Scott, who
is a dad trying to get back to a relationship with his daughter.
Yeah.
After messing up and going to prison.
Right. I mean, I just love the daughter and how much she loves him. And
yes,
even when he is kind of dumb or goofy.
Right. He gives her the most ugly rabbit present ever. And she loves it.
Stuffed animal. Because
it's from him.
It's from him. Yes.
But also, I think that he gets her sense of humor. Like, she's just the kind of kid who kind of likes weird, creepy, grotesque things. And and he gets it, whereas her mom and
mom's fiance's
stepdad don't quite get her.
Right. Right.
Although, I also, again, another movie where by the end of the movie, the stepdad fiance turns out to not be a terrible character and is actually kind of a good stepdad.
Yes.
And like the relationship does not stay antagonistic. I really liked the fact that they brought that relationship full circle and made it okay for them to all sit around a table looking at photos and laughing and eating and
recognizing what's important is the girl.
Right.
The daughter, Cassie.
And it didn't have to continue to be a fight.
Yes. And the antagonism between the adults. Yeah, that's true. I did like that. So, all right. So let's move on. We wanted to talk a little bit. It's getting long here, but I want to talk a little bit about the gospel today. The gospel, in case you don't remember, was Jesus speaking in the synagogue where he says, "Today the scripture passage is fulfilled in your hearing." This is from Luke chapter 4. And all were amazed that the gracious words came from his mouth. And they asked, "Isn't that the son of Joseph?" And then he gives them the old, in your native place, the things that we heard were done in Capernaum. And he said, "No prophet is accepted in his own native place." And that got them mad. because then he tells them about how, you know, Elijah was rejected and so on and so forth. And Elisha and the people were so mad, they rose up, drove him out of the town, led him to the brow of the hill on which the town had been built to hurl him down headlong. But Jesus passed through the midst of them and went away.
Yeah, I mean, wow. The reaction is so very strong.
Yes. Well, nobody likes to be told, you know, I'm from your town. I'm one of you, but I'm not going to, but, you know, I'm rejecting you, you know. Like, he's the celebrity prophet now, and right. He's rejecting them. In fact, what he's telling them, though, is you don't have a particular claim on me. And in some ways, he's a little like Bruno. He's predicting the future, you know, in a sense. You're going to reject me. No prophet is welcome in his own town. And rather than say, oh, wow, we shouldn't reject him, they fulfill the prophecy.
Right? Oh, it's that self-fulfilling prophecy. Also, it's kind of interesting that, like, here you see very clearly at the beginning of his ministry that Jesus did not have to let himself be arrested
at the garden,
in the Garden of Gethsemane.
Right.
When the crowds come for him, he could have done what he does here and in several other places. He could have just
walked
right through them
and went away
and gone away. He did not have to let himself be arrested and put to death. It was not a case of, like,
he let himself be led like a lamb to the slaughter.
Yeah.
For our sake. And that's the key thing, is that Jesus wasn't hauled away against his will, kicking and screaming, "No, it's not fair. No, I'm innocent." No, he went on our behalf because we weren't. I love the image of him just, like, walking through them and them all going, "Hey, where'd he go?" We were just about to throw him off the hill and he's gone.
Right. It's that complete and total inexplicable, like, there is no explanation for what happened.
I hope they put this in The Chosen.
I want to see how they do that.
Yeah. I don't know if everything will be in The Chosen.
How do you do that visually?
I think you just have him kind of start walking past them and them not realizing he is. Like you have a crowd of angry people, rah, 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 yelling at the front, and he just walks through them and they don't even see him. They don't even, like, turn to recognize that he's going past them. That's how I would do it. That's how I've always pictured it.
Hmm.
But, you know, different artistic visions. We'll choose differently. I mean, I wonder if they'll do this. I mean, The Chosen tends to be, we've only seen most of the first season so far.
Right.
So they may have already done this in the second season, who knows. But The Chosen tends to be, have a more, focus more on the upbeat sort of stuff. Although they're going to do the crucifixion, so I'm not sure, there's no way to do that upbeat. So
right.
Who knows? But that's a whole nother discussion. But the interesting thing was the comparison to Bruno, the prophet in his own town who's unwelcome and has to, you know, pass through them unseen to be, because, you know, the people don't like the prophecy that they hear. I mean, so Bruno is kind of a Christ figure in this.
Interesting. And he kind of actually, yeah, the way he's drawn and portrayed, he's kind of long, scraggly hair.
Yeah.
Beard.
He's got that look of the wild prophet.
Wild-eyed. I mean, yeah. He actually kind of looks a little bit more John the Baptist, but
that's, yeah, I was thinking, yeah.
And then the cloak, he's wearing this like big hooded cloak thing.
Right.
Yeah.
It's interesting to see. I mean, in fact, when we watch it again, I do want to kind of look at it in those eyes again, like he is perhaps a Christ-like figure in this story. So we'll see. Anything else about that gospel? I mean, it's a pretty good gospel. Yeah, it's okay.
It's just okay.
Yeah, I mean, as far as gospels go, no. It was interesting that they paired that with the First Corinthians, love is patient, love is kind.
Right.
It bears all things, believes all things. But it's the second half, I think, that has to do with it, because it says, love never fails. If there are prophecies, they'll be brought to nothing. If tongues, they will cease. If knowledge, it will be brought to nothing. It was an interesting repetition there. I'm not sure the RSV does that. Anyway, but when the perfect comes, the partial will pass away. I think it's trying to say is like, you know, faith, hope, and love remain, but the greatest of these is love. And so Jesus's prophecy, it's not that it will pass away, but there I had it, but I think I lost it, but I'm not sure I get why it connects, but I may have to go back over it and think about it again. In any case,
I think it's the fullness of the vision that we will have in heaven is such that all prophecies are going to appear like it's like the blurb on the back of the book. Like once you've read the book, you don't need the prophecy because you've seen.
You don't need the blurb because you know the story.
You know the story. Like the prophecy itself is only the.
And you'll see how inadequate the trailer to the movie was once you've seen the movie.
Right. Like the trailer like leaves out all the bits. You it's a jumble. You don't know how it fits together until you've seen the fullness of the movie. And then after that, like who goes back and watches the trailer?
Well, and it's kind of I sometimes do. But
okay.
Well, but it's funny because a lot of times a trailer will come out for a movie and then you'll have all this discussion of what it all means. And extrapolating from the trailers, what the movie is going to be about. And the Millennium Falcon is going to be in Book of Boba Fett. And because that ship that right there looks like the Millennium Falcon, turns out it's not, you know, it's just another ship in Star Wars, you know, and it's like we do all that and then we see it. We see that we've seen the whole thing when we're in the beatific vision, we're in heaven and we're like, oh yeah, we were way off. Like, oh wow. We were, you know, we didn't, we thought we knew things. We didn't know. We thought we could speak well, you know, and if tongues, they will cease. We didn't know anything about speaking well. We thought we loved well. We know nothing about love until we get to heaven.
Right. Like is what we have, the best things that we have now, are such pale foretastes, such pale imitations of it, that in the blazing glory of heaven, it's just going to...
We're going to laugh. Yeah. We're going to laugh at what we thought was important or what was good.
I can kind of grasp it when I think about being pregnant for the first time with Isabella. And I remember spending hours like thinking about what is she going to look like? What's her face going to be like? What are her hands going to look like? And I couldn't, my brain could not come up with a picture that held a candle to the reality of holding my daughter in my arms and finally seeing her face. Like her face was just so much more amazing. And her life as it's unfolded over the past 15 years, I couldn't have dreamed. I couldn't have imagined what this person who's so central to my life was like before she was born, and yet I loved her so much, but right. I what I loved like was just a pale shadow of who she is, like has been revealed to me once she was born.
Right.
and watching her grow up, you know? So there's that sort of sense of, we know a little bit, but we really don't know anything at all.
There's also the mystery of the faith, hope, and love remain. Even in heaven, there will be faith, hope, and love, which is an interesting idea, because faith is the knowledge, is believing things you can't yet see. Hope is the knowledge of the things that are yet to be being good. I'm misquoting Hebrews, but you know what I mean.
Right.
But yeah, we still have them. They still remain. But love is the big, but they're different, because we know it. We will know then. We won't have to have faith to know, and the hope will be realized. But love remains. Love still is what it is at its base. Interesting. Anyway, we'll go on and on and on, but I'm not going to. So let's wrap things up. I want to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including Frank and Angela S., Whitney C., Burke I., Faker Mage, and Michelle L. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. So we'd love to hear from you, get your feedback, just like we got from Rashad at the beginning of the show. Let us know what you think by commenting at sqpn.com/bets, that's B-E-T-T-S, or the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. You can send an email to bets@sqpn.com, go to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/StarQuestMedia, or you'll also find links from our discussion in our show notes at sqpn.com. If you can, we'd really appreciate it to go to Apple Podcasts or Spotify, now you can do this, and write a review or rate the show, give a nice 5-star rating, and then share the podcast with your friends. Help us grow this community and reach more listeners. Until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.